Rudy talked a lot about the richness of the phenomenology of black hole variability, and I will try to take a whole different approach to it. I'm going to start from asking very simple questions to going into increasingly more complex. And I'm going to look into our theoretical understanding of black hole accretion disks and into the data in order to find patterns and clues that are going to help us produce a model for black hole variability. And the ultimate goal is to look very deep into the gravitational well of black holes and probe effects that occur only around strong field gravity, and therefore learn something about general relativity. And I said I'm going to start with a very simple questions, and if you got something out of Rudy's talk, is that black holes are very variable. And the simple question is why? Well, presumably that has a very simple answer as well. The only reason that we believe that black holes accrete at the high rates that produce the luminosities that we see is that they're very turbulent. And even if you start with a nice, smooth Keplerian flow, like in this calculation by John Hawley, the way that Charles Gamy talked about yesterday, very soon the magnetorotational instability kicks in and the flow becomes very turbulent. Turbulent flow means very large variations in the density, in the temperature, in the velocities, and therefore very high variability. So maybe you would think that's the answer to your question. Black holes are very variable because accretion flows are very turbulent. But reality turns out to be as far away from this possible explanation as it can really be. And one of the important problems is that, as I will show in a second, all the characteristic frequencies in such an accretion flow have a strong dependence in radius, and therefore it's very surprising that variability in black holes and in neutron stars appears as quasi-coherent oscillations, quasi-periodic oscillation. Why don't we see turbulence? Why don't we see broadband variability only, and we see characteristic frequencies to be picked up? And in order to give you an idea of what characteristic frequencies I'm talking about, you would presume that all these quasi-periodic oscillations occur at dynamical frequencies. And in the case of a Newtonian, Newtonian object, there is only one dynamical frequency, the Keplerian frequency. In the case of general relativity, there are three, because the three different directions in space-time are different. And here I have shown the expressions to first order, and here I have plotted the frequencies normalized to a two-solar mass compact object and radius in gravitational units. And at a given radius, the fastest frequency is given here by the green line. This is the Keplerian frequency. This is the oscillation of a fluid element in the azimuthal direction, just the orbit. Now let's assume that I take an ensemble of test particles or fluid elements at a given radius in orbit, and I pinch it in the radial direction. Then this ensemble is going to oscillate in the radial direction with a frequency different than the Kepler frequency. We're in general relativity here. And the radial epicyclic frequency of that oscillation is given here by the blue line. It has a maximum at a few Schwarzschild radii and drops at zero to zero. This is for a rotating object, by the way. Drops to zero at what is called the innermost stable circular orbit. If I try to perturb an orbit inside that radius, there is no oscillatory frequency within the plunging region. And if I make a vertical perturbation to that ring of particles, then because of frame dragging effects, the orbital plane of the perturbation is going to precess because of vertical motions, and the frequency of precession is nothing but the frame dragging frequency, which is given here by the red line or the purple line. The important point two important points to get out of this figure is that we have three finite, different, and non-zero frequencies because we're in general relativity. And one of them has a very interesting behavior, has a maximum and drops to zero. And the second thing is that all of them have a very strong dependence on radius, which means that if you want to produce a quasi-coherent oscillation, you have to be able either to excite it in a narrow range of radii in a small annulus or trap it there. So you want the frequency cavity to trap your characteristic modes, and if you have done any mode analysis in your life, you realize that this turnover of the radial epicyclic frequency is going to give you such a frequency cavity. And let me explain how. That leads us to the study of linear modes in accretion disks, the whole field of disco seismology, which was pioneered by Soji Kato in the early 80s and then was developed and applied to the case of general relativistic compact objects by Mike Novak and Bob Wagoner and a number of other people. And if you have any time, please read Mike's papers because they're really important in that field. The way that you do going after that is you realize that an accretion disk, a geometrically thin accretion disk, is very thin in the vertical direction. That's the definition of it. It's periodic in the azimuthal direction. But as far as the black hole is concerned, it's infinite in the radial direction. So in order to do normal mode analysis, you separate your problem, you separate the radial dependence with the other two dependencies, and you do a WKB approximation in the radial direction, small wavelength approximation. And then you end up with a dispersion relation that looks more or less like that, and this is very reminiscent of the heliosismology dispersion relations. That's why this is called the discosismology field. This is the frequency of the mode, correlating with the flow, but for now let's call it the mode of the frequency. This is a separation variable, the mode number. This is the Kepler frequency, the green line, frequency of the mode, epicyclic frequency of the mode, sound speed, radial wave number. And what this equation tells you is that modes at different directions are coupled because of pressure forces. If I make an azimuthal perturbation, I'm going to perturb the density, I'm going to perturb the pressure, pressure is isotropic, it's going to lead to a perturbation in the other dimension. But it tells you something else which is more important, that if I look, for example, at a mode that has a low frequency, below the Kepler frequency, the part in the square bar bracket is a negative number. This is a perfect square, and therefore the part in the parenthesis has to be a negative number. And therefore, for this type of modes, which will turn out to be the G modes, the only way that they can exist is if their frequency is lower than the radial epicyclic frequency. But the radial epicyclic frequency has this characteristic shape, and therefore if I put a mode around there, it will exist only in a narrow range of radii, such that its frequency is inside this cavity. And that's exactly the way that you can trap these modes to exist in a narrow range of radii. This is one of the particular modes that you can trap. There are more, and I will describe them in a second. But the important point is you can trap characteristic modes in an accretion disk only because of general relativity. If you put a not a reflective boundary condition on the compact object, like in the case of a black hole, you cannot trap them in Newtonian dynamics. And you have a number of those modes, and you can categorize them depending on what's, these are oscillatory modes, on what's producing the dominant return force in the mode. And for example, if that is inertia and gravity, that is the combined net effect of gravity and centrifugal force, and we call them the G modes, this is the kind of modes that I talked before, frequencies of the order of the radial epicyclic frequency, and if you assume a non-axis symmetry, then you get different multiples of the Keplerian frequency. And this is a nice animation that looks a little choppy here by Mike Novak that shows the overdensity or overpressure perturbation during the cycle of the mode. This is distance from the black hole in gravitational units 7, 8, 9, 10, and you see the mode is confined in a narrow range of radii. That's why it has such kind of a frequency. You can get other types of modes that were discovered in the 90s. For example, the C mode, which is a corrugation one-armed mode, vertically incompressible mode that describes more or less nothing but vertical perturbations of the accretion disk near the innermost stable circular orbit, and the frequency for the first order mode comparable to the frame dragging frequency. Or if what gives the restoring force is mostly pressure, you have inertial acoustic modes, which have frequencies much smaller than the G mode frequency, and actually very narrow extents. We don't really believe that these modes produce significant amplitude luminosity perturbations. Two important things about these modes is that they all lie very close to the marginally stable orbit, and therefore they have frequencies in the hundreds of hertz. And the second thing is that their frequencies are determined by the properties of space-time, and therefore they're not expected to change during an observation because the mass and the spin of the compact object is not expected to change. And therefore these kinds of these kinds of modes are prime candidates for explaining the high frequency stable QPOs that we see in black holes, some of the high frequency QPOs that Rudy pointed at. And of course if you have one of them, then you don't know which mode to pick, you know, there's nothing that you can do. But over the last year we started observing black holes with pairs of QPOs. And then you can learn something about the black hole properties. And this is the way that you do it. This first argument is based on a work by both Wagner and collaborators that was published late last year. And I'm going to reproduce it here in a slightly different way to tell you how it works. Using some sort of Occam's razor, you can say that you expect the highest amplitude of variability in the lowest order modes. So you pick the lowest order modes, you throw away your P mode, it's not going to produce significant amplitude of variations. So you have one G mode and one C mode. You have two frequencies and two modes that depend on only two parameters, the mass of the black hole and the specific angular momentum in units of mass of the black hole, the two care parameters. And you say, 450 hertz, I call it my C mode. It's one frequency, two parameters that determines a line in this plot. 300 hertz, I call it the other mode. One frequency, two parameters, that determines another line in this mode, in this plot, and the point where they intersect gives me the mass and the spin of the black hole in that particular compact object. I have a little slack here because I can pick the other pair, like the high frequency to be the G mode and the low frequency to be the C mode, so I have only 1 degree of freedom here. And in that case, I get another pair of parameters and another pair of curves. These are the only two values of the mass and spin of the black hole that the linear mode analysis becomes consistent with the observations. 1655 is a source for which the mass has been measured very nicely from dynamical mass measurements in the optical. You plug that in, and one of the two solutions is smacking in the center of the allowed mass range. Remember, there was no free parameter in the model besides the freedom of which mode to choose with what frequency. And yet a totally independent measurement of the mass of the compact object is where the model wants it to be. And since you like to pick that mass of the compact object, you have to pick that spin that gives you a spin parameter of the order of 0.9, 90%. That makes some people happy because this is one of the microquasars. That makes some people unhappy because this is a rather high value of the spin of the black hole. That's what you can learn from linear mode analysis, but then you can go one further beyond and say, well, you know, it's linear mode analysis, that's probably not what's happening. And after all, there's a piece of information that we didn't use. The two frequencies that we use, one is 450 hertz, the other is 300 hertz, have a 3-to-2 ratio, reminds you of resonance. Resonance tells you nonlinear mode analysis. Therefore, why don't we forget the mode analysis that we've done so far and conjecture that the modes are going to occur where you have a small number resonance between different types of G modes, for example, between the radial epicyclic frequency and the Keplerian frequency. Observations give you a 3-to-2 resonance, 450 to 300. You can do it with the same resonance, or you can do it with a 3-to-1 resonance, 400 and 150, the difference, or a 2-to-1, 300 and 150. And because you don't know where the mode is produced, you have a degree of freedom, and therefore, depending on what resonance you pick in the same plot, you get a line that connects all the masses and spins that are consistent in principle with the data. This is just a conjecture. But then if you use the observed mass of the compact objects from dynamical mass measurements, then you realize that the 3/2 cannot do it, no matter how you try. It has to be one of those two resonances and gives you a dimensional spin parameter of the compact object of the order of 0.4. Which of the two is correct? It's not obvious. This one has a lot more physics, but doesn't take into account one part of the observations, the 3-to-2 ratio. This takes into account the part of the observations, but is a conjecture. We'll have to work harder to make this mode, and this idea, by the way, is by Katten, Abramovich, and Klusnik late last year. We have to work a little harder and go to the nonlinear mode analysis and try to calculate these modes and see if it really works. But I wanted to point out that the final, whatever the answer is, it gives us a very important property of the black holes, and this is probably the only way we have to measure it, and that is the spin of the black hole. And that is very important to go and understand both the physics of this model and the comparison with observations. So this is what happens with this case of the stable high-frequency QPOs. But let me go back to my original simple question, where does the variability come from? We said we have these frequencies of the QPOs, we have to trap them, but are we happy with the answer? And the answer is that, I mean, following up on that question, one has to ask, where does the rest of the variability come from? And you can say, well, that's another easy answer. Things that go close, that happen close to the black hole are fast, so they give me the high frequency of variability. Things that happen far away from the black hole are very slow, they give me the low frequency variability. And I plotted here to make that argument, the power spectrum of this source, GX39-4, is a function of frequency in hertz. You know, you get things anywhere from 1/100 of a hertz to up to 100 hertz, 4 orders of magnitude in frequency. And instead of plotting the variability power here, I plotted power times frequency. This is like the new plot in X-ray spectroscopy. Since you use log here, it's better to use this parameter to tell you where most of the variability is coming from. And then I make the assumption that I just told you. I assign to every frequency the characteristic radius that it corresponds to, assuming that it's the Keplerian orbit, assuming it's a dynamical frequency. And I get the following result. The biggest part of the variability happens from 1,000 Schwarzschild radii. And look at the numbers. This is 4% in power. That gives me 20% in variability amplitude, square root of that. That means 20% of the X-rays, which is for my taste, pretty much all of the X-rays, should be coming out at 1,000 Schwarzschild radii, if that is the answer. And therefore, this tells you that assigning different variability frequencies to different places in the accretion disk cannot be the answer to the problem. There's something else that's happening here, and most probably, as I will try to argue in a second, we have slow phenomena that happen, phenomena from slow to fast that happen close to the black hole where the X-rays are produced and give us this broad range of variability properties. And if you remember the initial range of dynamical frequencies that I showed you, you have things as fast as the Keplerian frequency, you have things as slow as the frame dragging frequency. And there's something else to look at this plot. People usually fit this kind of power spectra with power law components. And maybe there is a power law that could go like that, maybe there's a power law that could go like that, but there's some interesting peaks that are protruding through the power laws. And indeed, you can define two characteristic frequencies on this power spectrum. And you're wondering, okay, they're not as narrow as a QPO, but they must be telling us something about the variability. Point number one. Point number two to remember is that you can produce a very broad spectrum of variability, a very broad power spectrum, from a single harmonic oscillator, as long as you make it damp quite fast. The power spectrum of a damped harmonic oscillator is a Lorentzian, with a width equal to the damping time of the power spectrum. And just this particular idea gave, you know, the motivation to some people, and most importantly Mike Novak, to go and fit this kind of power spectra, not with power laws anymore, but with superposition of a few Lorentzians, and ask how many of those do we need, how many characteristic frequencies do we need. And this is again GX39-4, frequency times power, this is the way that we like to plot these days, versus frequency, 1, 2, 3, 4 Lorentzians, the data are fitted very well, or the bumps and the wiggles. And actually more than just how the data are fit, there are other properties of the rapid variability, like time lags, for example, that are more or less constant when one Lorentzian dominates and jump to another value when you cross from one Lorentzian to the other. There's a whole list of phenomenology here that you can go through that tells you that this superposition of a small number of damped harmonic oscillators is what produces this power spectra. And you can play this game for all the sources that you know. XTJ1118-+480, Cygnus X1, a nice paper by Katja Potsmit and collaborators this year. The previous one was from Tommaso Belloni. And if you're sick and tired of looking at black hole power spectra, you can go into the case of neutron stars, JS1826-24. This is the nicest X-ray burster that we know that fits the X-ray burst models the best. And we can argue whether this is significant or not, but you have Lorentzians, and the most weird neutron star source known today, Cygnus X1, 1, 2, 3 Lorentzians, produce the whole power spectrum. So most of the black hole source power spectra that I showed correspond to one particular source, but you can play the same game, not one particular state, but you can play the same game for all the other states as well. So point number one is we started with a very broad range of variability properties, and we narrowed down to a few harmonic oscillators that are just damped. Second important point is that all these frequencies vary. When you look at Cygnus X1 again and again and again, like Rudy showed for the other sources, it's not going to have the same frequencies, the same amplitudes, the same widths. And here's an example of that kind of variation for the first outburst of XT1550-564. This is the source that Rudy spent a lot of time on. Frequency times powers versus frequency. This is the power spectrum as it evolves during the beginning of the outburst cycle. You see these two narrow harmonically related QPOs that Rudy talked about, sitting on top of a broad Lorentzian, and when they go towards slower frequencies, another Lorentzian is going to show up here. The movie is just going up and down. So what we can do here is we can use our Lorentzian decomposition of the power spectra and calculate, let's forget for a while the, you know, the width, the amplitude, let's look at the frequency content of them only, and then pick one source that we like and plot pairs of correlations between the different pairs of Lorentzians that we use. And then we can be even bolder than that, actually we were bolder to begin with, and say let's put all these correlations on a single plot. And these are the kind of things that we'll look. This is the correlation of characteristic frequencies of the break frequency. This is the characteristic frequency of the lowest Lorentzian, we call it break, you will see in a little while why, versus the characteristic frequency of the next Lorentzian, the first above the lowest one. And this is a plot by Rudy Weinans and Michiel van der Klees, where you see black holes in black neutrons that are seen in red, and even an X-ray pulsar, the only known millisecond pulsar in CN. And you can trace individual sources by looking, for example, at only the dots. So this is Cygnus X1, the follow-on correlation. But then you put all the sources, neutron stars, black holes, whatever you like, correlation is over 3 orders of magnitude in frequency, and the relative shift between individual correlations is at most a factor of 2, probably less than that. You can play the same game in using other frequencies. This is something that we did with Tommaso Belloni and Michiel van der Klis. This is the same frequency as this one, and the horizontal axis is the next Lorentzian. Neutron stars here, black holes there. Most of these points are from the recent work from Potsmid et al. An amazingly tight correlation, more than 3 orders of magnitude in frequency, and encompasses both neutron stars and black holes. So what did we just do here? Again, we started from our broadband variability power spectrum. We said we don't need to know the frequencies, you know, of every what happens in every single frequency. We need 4 harmonic oscillators to describe it. And then we took all this, the frequencies of the 4 harmonic oscillators, and we said each one knows about the other. So we need only one parameter to describe the whole thing, as far as its frequency content is concerned. We can talk about amplitudes and widths later on. So this gives additional weight to the idea that I talked to you about earlier, that these are not phenomena that happen at different radii in the accretion disk, but that these are different phenomena that all happen very close to the inner edge of the disk, and they know about each other. So what is this parameter? Well, since this correlation seemed to know only about the fact that these objects are gravitational relativistic compact objects, and they don't care what is the temperature of the spectrum where you see them, what is the luminosity. These are observations that have widely different spectra and luminosities. It probably has something to do with the gravity of the compact objects and not with the disk physics. Gravity is what determines mostly what these modes are. And this is where the next nice piece of intuition came from Luigi Stella and Mario Vietri, who said, let's forget the normal mode analysis that we've talked so far. Let's assume that the mode somehow magically happens at one particular radius in the accretion flow, and let's allow this radius to vary. That's our single parameter, a magic radius. And you can do that, and you can try to fit the correlations. This is an earlier diagram of the same correlation with your data points. And here, instead of saying frequency number 2 versus frequency number 1, I plot the physical frequencies. Periastron precession frequency, omega minus kappa, nodal precession frequency, frame dragging frequency. The data, the correlation depends very weakly on the mass of the compact object. Maybe that's why black holes and neutron stars follow more or less the same correlation. Depends rather strongly on the spin parameter of the compact object. And indeed, the points from here to here are one source in X1, and they align with one of those monoparametric curves for a single value of alpha. And you get spin parameters of the order of, you know, 10% to 40% from maximum. Seems to be working fine within the statistics. Then we can go to another correlation that I didn't show you so far, because for black holes, it's very hard to make it at this point. We know a lot more from the case of neutron stars, frequency number 2 versus frequency number 3, the next Lorentzian that we have to use. Kepler frequency, periastron precession frequency, the same as this one. 12 neutron star sources, and you can, this correlation depends almost entirely on the mass of the compact object, and you can fit the correlation for relatively high mass neutron stars, which is good because these neutron stars have been accreting matter for a long, long time, being X-ray binaries, and maybe they reach relatively high masses. Numerology up to here, we said we needed one parameter based on the data, and this parameter seems to be this magic radius. But let's assume that, and let's say, how can you produce, thank you, a variability at this characteristic radius? And as a second question, and as a first question, what can this radius be? Is it something that we have to pull out of the hat? And the idea of a characteristic transition in the disk properties is nowhere near being new in accretion disk physics. For example, if I didn't have a black hole and I had a neutron star, a magnetic neutron star in the center of the accretion flow, then I will have a disk magnetosphere interaction region. The magnetic field would totally destroy my Keplerian flow and produce and transition from an accretion disk to a field-aligned flow. And this is something that we have in the case of X-ray pulsars, and indeed there we see some QPOs with a whole different phenomenology, whose frequencies, however, scales with the torque that we measure on the neutron star, and the scaling is in such a way that is consistent with saying that the QPOs are producing that characteristic radius. This is a nice work by Mark Fingel a few years ago now. But we can forget about that here. These are black holes, after all. We have very sharp transition fronts between hot parts of the accretion flow and cold part of the accretion flows when we have unstable accretion flows and dwarf nova instabilities, for example. The transition is very fast, and it has been actually used by Yamasaki and Kato a few years ago to try to model dwarf nova oscillations that are variable frequency, very high coherence oscillations in the case of a white dwarf. And something else that we worked in the case of variability around neutron stars with Cole Miller and Fred Lamp is a transition, sharp transition in the properties of an accretion disk produced by radiation drag. If you put in an accretion flow in a strong radiation field that is not co-rotating with the flow, then you have something like Poynting-Robertson effect. You have drag in the orbits of the particles, then you produce a very sharp transition from Keplerian orbit to more or less a free-flowing, free-falling or particle motions. So the question is, who knows what the answer is? It cannot be this magnetosphere interaction. Maybe it's this one. Maybe it's the third one. Maybe it's something that we haven't figured out. But it seems that whatever these three processes are going to produce are going to tell us where the radius is happening, but the frequencies have to be produced by gravity, because that's where the frequencies that were correlating well the same way that the data were. And how do you go around solving that? Well, we tried to do something with Colin Norman a couple of years ago, and we said we don't care what produces this transition. As long as we can separate our disk to a Keplerian orbit outside this transition region, a disk full of Keplerian orbits, and a plunging region inside this transition region. And then we're going to calculate the jump condition, more or less, like as if you had a shock, the jump condition from the Keplerian part of the flow to the free-flowing part of the flow, and say what kind of perturbations that I excite out there are going to propagate through. And what you have, it's a very simple idea, and the way to understand it is that what we have there, we have oscillating fluid elements, orbital velocity in the azimuthal direction, radial velocity in the radial direction, frame dragging frequency in the vertical direction. We drive those oscillators because we have turbulence, we assume turbulence at the outer part of the accretion disk, and we dump these oscillators because we assume viscosity. And therefore, if I try to answer what is the jump condition, how do these perturbations are going to propagate through, it's going to be like a filter, like a damped harmonic oscillator. And you can plot the response function of that filtering as a function of the frequency of the perturbations, and I chose here parameters for the case of a neutron star, but it's the same idea. And as in the case of harmonic oscillators, you get resonances at all the characteristic frequencies, the normal modes of the oscillation, if the fluid elements were let alone to oscillate the way they wanted. So you get characteristic resonances at the nodal frequency, periastron precession frequency, orbital frequency, all the frequencies that you want in order to explain the observed correlations. We are a long way from making that kind of an argument into a model in which we have to have a way to produce a transition in the accretion flow and have to be able to calculate the modes in that transition and the way that they propagate through. But something important is that we have a way, if we impose a transition in the accretion flow, to produce these characteristic frequencies, and we have a way to produce Lorentzian shapes. These are damped harmonic oscillators. All of these shapes are Lorentzians. I picked them to be very narrow to explain narrow, relatively coherent QPOs and X-ray, neutron star X-ray binaries, but if you make them damped very quickly, you can produce broadband variability the same way that we see in the case of black holes. So this is where we are at this point, trying to understand the frequency content of the power spectrum, but there's a lot more that one can do because, as I said, there's more information in the Lorentzians, for example, the width, the coherence of the QPOs, or the relative amplitude. And I want to say just something about the relative coherence of the QPOs, and that is, even though the frequencies are determined almost entirely by gravity, the coherence of the QPOs is determined by disk physics, what causes the viscosity. And therefore, by looking at that, we can learn something about what causes the viscosity and how strong is the viscosity, viscous angular momentum transfer in accretion disk. And if you assume more or less isotropic turbulence for any type of models, the kind of modes that Mike Novak has been talking about, the things that Colin Norman and I were talking about, the coherence of the mode will be more or less inversely proportional to the equivalence occurrence in the I viscosity parameter. So if you want to learn something about this viscosity parameter, you pick the most coherent mode. In the case of a neutron star, the coherence can go as up to as high as 200, but here it's a black hole emitting. Let's forget that for a second, that's too difficult. Let's pick the most coherent high-frequency QPO that we see in the case of a black hole. That is by Strohmeyer in 1655-20, who measured coherences as high as 20. Use this inequality, use the squiggle here, you get that the equivalence occurrence in the IF parameter at the inner accretion disk should be at most of the order of a couple of percent. This is the level of the argument that you can make using simple analytic estimates, you know, these little order of magnitude estimates. But in order to make any progress, you have to go to numerics. Because first of all, we have a very strong assumption here. If the turbulence does not couple very well to the vertical modes of the accretion disk, you're going to get different powers of the viscosity parameter. And we know a way of producing turbulence in accretion disks, and it will be interesting to see what exactly is the dependence of the coherence on that. But also, there is the effective viscosity that we assumed as a constant has very wild variations in numerical simulations as far as radius is concerned, as far as time is concerned. And so I think the way to look for answers is look into the MHD simulations and try to answer this question. And to give you an idea of how this might work, how near or how far we are, this is the time average, azimuth average, effective Sakura-Sundiaev potential that you would calculate using the MHD simulations of Holly and Krolik that were published a year or so ago. You see it's more or less, it's hovering around 0.1, like 10% of, 0.1, and near the inner edge where the you want these modes to be trapped, it goes up to very high values. There's a couple of reasons why it's going to these very high values. First of all, the viscosity measures the ratio of the magnetic stresses to pressure. When you go near the marginally stable orbit, the flow accelerates very high. To very high velocities, density drops, pressure drops, alpha viscosity parameter goes very high. You also have, when you cross this plunging region, effectively what you do is you kick your fluid elements over a cliff. And if you remember the kind of cartoon picture of the MRI instability that Charles talked about the other day, you have two fluid elements that are connected by a magnetic spring. You kick one over the cliff, you might make the viscous transport stronger. But in any case, you get relatively high values of the viscosity parameter, and this is the kind of level that you expect just based on this argument, assuming that this argument is valid there. So maybe by looking into the coherences of these oscillations, we're going to learn something about the viscosity properties in the accretion flows. But this kind of argument might also tell us why, when we look at the numerical simulations that people have been publishing, we don't really see many of these quasi-coherent oscillations. Maybe because the conditions are such that the viscosity is so high that you actually kill the modes, because if you make the alpha parameter of order unity, you destroy the coherence of any such mode that you're going to see in your flow. But I think this is the kind of study that one needs to do in order to learn something about disk physics from looking at the variability properties of black holes. And in any case, since I'm almost out of time, let me tell you what I tried to convince you during this talk. The first thing is that trying to build models of black holes is very different from trying to forecast weather. As somebody pointed out earlier, you might expect that all the variability comes out of turbulence and it's something random that you might have some hope to learn by doing some statistical modeling. This is not how black hole variability is about. It follows very nice patterns and has very narrow type of frequencies, and any characteristic model, any successful model has to be able to explain those characteristic frequencies. The return of that is very big because, as I said, most of these frequencies depend almost entirely on the gravity of the compact object and a little on the accretion disk physics, so we should be able to learn things about gravity fields, properties of accretion disks, mass and spins of black holes. And since this is a meeting about, you know, 3 years after what happened since the previous meeting, I just prepared another transparency to make things funnier towards the end, and also make a point that this is a very young field. I used the marvels of ABS and Unix scripting to write out what are the total numbers of papers that were published, in especially describing black hole variability in the last few years. And these are the observational papers, and you see an enormous increase over the last 2 or 3 years. And that's almost entirely due because of Rossi Explorer. Rossi Explorer gave us all the capabilities to measure these frequencies and learn all these wonderful things that we have learned so far. So it's a very young research field with great data, but if you were to do the same plot with theoretical models, you see it's about 2 papers in a year, and therefore there's a lot of room and especially a lot of need for good theoretical work for this field, but the returns are going to be very important, and I would like to stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the y-axis against the z-axis and the x-axis.
It doesn't have to, but it's more, I mean, better to look. Yeah.
If you took the quasi-periodic variability seen in dwarf novae in numbers, where would they lie on the curve? They're multiple periodic.
Yes. It is an interesting point, and many of us thought of going back and doing it. If I can find the correlation, here it is. Well, I can look at, show it in this correlation and go and look at it. I don't know if anybody who has done any systematic search of this double frequencies, QPOs, and see how they look. There was a single paper that I saw about a year ago on AstroPH where people found two simultaneously detected frequencies in dwarf novae oscillations, and they put it on the plot. That's why the only reason that I know about it, and it was down here following, extrapolating the same correlation. It's just a single point. I don't want to say too much about it. The relativity is going to be the same wherever you look at it. It's just going to go to ridiculously small frequencies. It doesn't cut off at any point. And I don't know how much weight to give on that. But it might be interesting to look at white dwarfs. But it's very highly variable.
And it's highly variable.
Yeah.
And so all the recent, and not for recent, but I think it's very evident in this case that there's something sliding on the surface of the dwarf. And it was, if it was correlated with neutron star, that problem
would be. Of course.
My comment was about the value of alpha. From GPOs and found it too low compared with simulation.
But of course, this has a very big.
It's not a real problem because these are, as Charles pointed out, they are not real alpha bits. But you have problems with dwarf novae where you can measure the alpha in the high state between alpha. And alpha is 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. So probably the problem is not with the simulations, but with the simple assumption, as you pointed out.
Sure. Yeah, this was meant to be just the way things are going to go and why it's interesting. Yeah. But of course, these simulations have nothing to do with alpha disk, and the mode analysis have nothing to do with MHD turbulence. But somebody has to mix them together.
This value is probably too low.
Could be. Yes, well, I didn't talk at all about any of the results of numerical simulations just because I didn't have time to do it. And indeed, there's different types of work, and the work from your group shows that there might be other modes of planets to consider when you go away from the alpha disk prescription. That's correct. Well, that's also something else that they didn't point at all in my talk, that whatever I've been discussing is modes in the density perturbations or velocity perturbations or pressure perturbations. To turn them into X-ray luminosity perturbations is a link that nobody has. I mean, there's some ideas around about comptonization, but nobody has really worked. But I'm going to take the problem and put it in another part and saying that we don't really know what produces the DC part of the spectrum. So before we try to make predictions about what produces the AC, the variable part of the spectrum, I want to believe what causes the DC part of the spectrum. And I myself spend enough time on that not to want to get into it again.
Thank you.
Yes. How do you compare galactic black holes with AGN, right? Well, that's a whole other story. And I actually had a transparency and a view graph, I guess, that I decided not to show at the end. It is very hard when you want to go from galactic black holes to the AGN, because the galactic black holes, the power spectra varies so much, as I showed, in time scales, that if you were to extrapolate in the case of the AGN, it would be of the order of a Hubble time, more or less. And therefore, when you want to make this comparison, you have to be able to say, what do you compare it with? It is indeed true that all the frequencies become narrow. I mean, all the quasi-periodic oscillations become narrow and narrow, and you go towards higher frequencies, and they become less and less coherent as you go to lower frequencies. And maybe that's one reason why we don't see in supermassive black holes narrow phenomena. Who knows? But I think we're far from being able to finding something that is really constant and always there in the case of galactic black holes, and say, well, if you see that in the case of an AGN, then you know what it is. So I don't think we're anywhere near giving a good answer to that problem.
Just a question, make one comment and then ask a question. Mm-hmm. The comment is in the simulation, the region near the markedly stable orbit seems to be a very fruitful source of fluctuations on a very wide range of frequencies. And that may be a place to look for
I'm not sure what you're asking exactly. I could come from two different ways to answer that, or try to find an answer from that to that question. And one is, as a theorist, if I were to predict before I saw, I would say there's absolutely no way that you're going to produce narrow frequency, I mean coherent quasi-periodic oscillations. However, I have seen quasi-periodic oscillations with Qs as high as 200 around neutron stars. So there must be a way that it works. But, well, that is the second part of the question. Now, the frequencies that are the most coherent are variable frequencies, and therefore they cannot be the kind of normal modes in viscous cosmology. And that's what led Colin Norman and I to think about what you're doing is you're filtering all this broad band of perturbations through a transition into a plunging region, which doesn't produce any additional turbulence, and you're scaling it like that. But, you know, going from that to saying, explaining why the turbulence doesn't, or why the instability doesn't exist anymore in the plunging region, this is an extended plunging region, is a whole other story, which we have to work a little harder on.
I was just wondering, I had the impression you left some points out. The point you were making, yeah, in this plot, the point you were making here is that, well, it's very optimistic and it all seems to be one nice correlation. But I was just wondering why you left, for instance, some of the points of 1550 and other points like star sources, why you left them out of this relation?
In the original plot that we have done, we had left not a single point out. And, I mean, you can say that's the answer to the question. As more and more, now that we know that we can fit these observations with multiple Lorentzians, this is not the only correlation that exists. I'm showing a number of those correlations because you have four Lorentzians, you can get all the different types of correlations that you have. And there's some that are flat, there's some that are steeper, both neutron stars and black holes. And we can, in the same way that you can produce a whole number of modes in an accretion flow. These are the ones that are the most striking ones, and these are the ones that we believe we know or we have a reason how to explain them, but there's no points left out.
mass correlation to find this.
I mean, something that I said 3 years ago, and I'm going to say it now, is that I would be very happy to see a diagram like that that is messy and doesn't show characteristic lines.
Thank you very much.